this. We're just going to kind of walk through it. I'm not going to read the whole passage. We'll kind of take it step by step. That's how we've been doing it at youth group lately, too. We just kind of take a passage, chew on it, move on, connect it to the next piece. So, Romans 8:28. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. So, just for frame of reference, if you have been called according to his purpose, if you love him, you've been made new, you're his. This applies to you, okay? If you're his, then everything, good and bad, will be used according to his plan for you. According to his plan for everything going on, to orchestrate his plan through history and your individual part in it. This is a promise, okay? He will, and it's, I mean, it says, and we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Not that we'd always agree it's good for us at the time, but that's what he says. How amazing is that? Just, I don't know if you've ever really considered that before. I mean, you've all mostly, I would think, have heard the verse before, but let that penetrate everything. Everything. Good and bad. Even the bad stuff you brought on yourself. He wants to use, he will use for your good if you love him and are called according to his purpose. However, this is usually brought up when? When people are down in the dumps, they're whatever has happened and they're feeling rotten, they, you know, something tragic has happened. And, you know, when someone's going through a difficult time, even though it very much applies, it's really hard to take. Especially if you haven't, like, been totally given to this. If you haven't totally been immersed and watching his plan unfold in the good and the bad things already. You know, if you aren't totally given to the understanding that his love is working everything to your good, ultimately. It can be really hard to take when somebody says, oh, don't worry. Don't you know what Romans 8:28 says? You know. And at that point, people understandably choose their feelings over the fact, over the truth. And it's understandable. And that's really how something becomes cliche, you know? This really good truth can't really be accepted, can't really be trusted. And so, yeah, we hear that all the time. Yeah, it's true, but we don't give it any credit. We don't give it any power. Therefore, we don't give him any power because we're not already given to it. Move on to verse 29 through 30. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the likeness of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those he predestined, he also called. And those he called, he also justified. And those he justified, he also glorified. Now, with this passage, I want you to understand, people jump all over words like foreknew and predestined, okay? And while they do illuminate the whole idea of election and everything, that's not where he's heading in this passage. It's certainly a component of it. It certainly illuminates what he says in Romans 9 about election and God's plan and predestination, all that kind of stuff. But that's not where he's driving here. So don't get hung up on that, okay? What these verses are is really a general view of his plan. You see, it starts before the beginning of anything and ends at the end of everything. Okay? I mean, it starts with those God foreknew, those he knew ahead of time, okay? He also predestined to become conformed to the likeness of his Son. So everyone he knew was going to come in, and Romans 9 would illustrate planned to come in, he predestined to conform them to be like Jesus. And then, so this is all before time began, okay? And then you've got, those he predestined, he also called. Now, we're on the scene, okay? We've gotten to the point in time. We go from, see, I'm going from right to left. I'll go your way. Before anything has happened, before creation, he knew, and he predestined to become, you know, those who will know him, to become like his Son. Then we get to the point where we step on the scene, believers step on the scene, and he calls us. Because no one can come to Christ unless the Father calls him, right? When he calls us, then the next step is he also justified us. And those he justified, he also glorified. Okay? And right there, we haven't gotten there yet. Anybody glorified? You don't look like it. Sorry. I would love that. I, you know, just walk through the wall for me. That'd be awesome. Sorry. One of those things about Jesus. Anyway. Jesus' new body. We're going to have bodies like him. I can't wait to be able to walk through a wall or something. That's just, wow. Maybe hide in the middle of the wall. No, anyway. Sorry, get a little sidetracked there. But anyway, so he's planned from eternity past, and he's got it planned through eternity future, who's going to be his. And this whole plan is, what's going on in this plan is he's working all things to the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Okay? Because this starts with four. You notice that? For those. So this is the direct connector to the plan he's got to work everything together for the good of those who love him is happening because he's had this plan from the beginning of time, before the beginning of time. That's really cool. And I love that it's a Hebrew device or whatever you want to call it, that even the stuff that hasn't happened yet is spoken of in past tense. He also glorified. Like I said, none of us are there yet. That's to communicate the certainty of it, like it's already done. Because it is already done. We haven't arrived yet. We haven't experienced it yet. But God promises it. He is faithful and he will do it. It is done. It is certain. Okay, so that's why it's in the past tense. And again, this is all planned out ahead of time about how he's going to take these adopted children of his and make them like his true son. Okay, let's go on to the next point here. The plan's certainty. Verse 31. What then shall we say in response to this? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? So it starts with a rhetorical question, right? You know, what then shall we say in response to this? You know, is it like giving up? I really don't see that in the text. I mean, what shall we say in response? If God is for us, who can be against us? You know what this is? Obviously, it's rhetorical. I mean, and the clear answer is nothing. What can we say to this? Nothing but fountains of gratitude. This is a celebration here. What? Do you realize this? What could we possibly say? Thank you's not enough. You know? If God is for us, who can be against us? God is doing this for us. What can man do to mess it up? God is working this out. What are they going to kill us? Jesus said not to fear the one who could, you know, kill the body, the one who could take your life and cast it into hell. Not even death. So people, who's going to come against us? Who's going to mess up this plan that God has for us? I'm even Satan. No, I mean, this gets to the point where I'm starting to think maybe I should have put an image of William Wallace up here. And just like, I mean, you know, he's doing this, you know, speech before the men, you know, before they go into battle and revving them up and telling them why they're doing, about to sacrifice their lives, you know, and we're going to, you know, and it's like, yes, you know, that's the vibe I see here is, what are we going to say to this? How can we respond? If God is for us, who could be against us? He will fulfill his plan he has for us, and that ends with sharing his glory. And the proof is in verse 32, Jesus' sacrifice. He didn't even spare God the Son to accomplish his purposes. Jesus is the promise. He is the seal in this deal. I mean, talk about sparing no expense. Not even the Son was spared. But he gave him for us all. And he doesn't stop there. He'll continue to supply us with everything he needs us to have to accomplish it. Check out verse 33. Who will bring any charge against those whom God has chosen? It is God who justifies. Who is he that condemns? Christ Jesus, who died, more than that, who was raised to life and is at the right hand of God and is also interceding for us. So right there, Paul issues a challenge. Who will bring any charge against us? Now, I had to clarify this for the youth. That doesn't mean if you cheat on a test or get a speeding ticket, you can't say, hey, you can't bring any charge against me. God has a plan for me, and I don't like that. You know, obviously, you know, don't take that the wrong way. Who will bring any accusations to God about us? You know, Satan, even Satan the accuser, okay? Who will say, God, you shouldn't love that person because X? He knows. And he's the one that's made us right with himself because of it. Who would dare? I think this is pretty neat, too. The only one who could bring an eternally binding accusation would be Christ. And that you can see in John 5:22. Moreover, the Father judges no one, but has entrusted all judgment to the Son. Okay? So if Jesus is the judge, and he's the example we're going to be judged by, so he's kind of the prosecution too, okay? And what does the verse say that we just read? He's at the right hand of God interceding for us. So the judge and prosecutor who was sacrificed for us willingly is for us. Not even that is interceding for us. The NLT even translates it pleading for us. Talk about an advocate. I mean, the one that would do the judging, who's going to bring an accusation to the one who's pleading for us? No one. It's that sure. And really, we should have great confidence in him and in his love and what he's going to do with us, even when it doesn't make sense to us, even when it looks like modern art. Okay? That's how we should see what we go through. And Paul's going to elaborate on that. Let's go on into the plan's power, rifling through this. I'm making up for the 50-minute sermon last time. No, just kidding. This one's going to take 30 minutes. No. Verse 35. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble, or hardship, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or danger, or sword? As it is written, for your sake we face death all day long and are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. Okay. This really is the meat of it, okay? This is the power, like the outline says. This is the power of it, okay? Grasp this. People have a tendency, when things go wrong, when things are hard, tragedy strikes, whatever, to think any number of things. I mean, even believers tend to think God's mad at them, or God doesn't really love them, or God isn't loving, or God doesn't really exist. You know, they start to question God's existence because times are hard. And again, like I said at the beginning, feelings are real things, and they are powerful, and it's understandable why people would wrestle with that. But let's wade through this list that Paul gives us as he tears down that notion. It's not defensible. It's real. You know, emotions are powerful, but it's not defensible. Paul tears down in a hurry. Check this out. We're going to wade through these with a little bit of visual help here. The first one, he says, you know, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? And there's a notion in there that I think is even put in the way the NLT says it, is, you know, does it mean God no longer loves us when, and then he makes this list of things that happen? Okay, so think about it like that. Does God no longer love us when trouble comes? If you might recognize that from a slideshow or two, that's the flat tire we had on the high school campout on a fairly busy road. Trouble. The Greek definition of that really lends itself to pressure or pressing. Okay, trouble. I can't remember what the word was in the NLT when we did it in youth group, but it's like those things that aren't always the tiniest deal, but in the grand scheme of things, aren't the biggest pain. You know, like a flat tire. And not only a flat tire, but a flat tire that you have to empty the entire bag contents from a camping trip from your van to get at the spare tire in order to jack it up and get the new spare tire on there. And then the new spare tire, I mean, when you put the old one back on there, you put it on upside down. So you have to take it all back out again. You know, that kind of trouble, that's a pain. That's frustrating. Does that mean God no longer loves us? Pretty easy to answer no. And maybe that's, you know, maybe that's a stub your toe. Maybe that's a whack your thumb with a hammer. Maybe that's, you know, kids that make your eyes bleed at one day. Just or lose your hair. Love you. Anyway, that's trouble. They're real, and they can really consume your day even. But doesn't mean that God no longer loves us? No. Pretty simple, no. Hardship is the next one. It's probably better translated dire calamity. And I think you can connect that pretty well with that image. You can all see that, right? You guys know what that is, right? Okay. Sudden catastrophe, sudden tragedy that brings doubt. I imagine all you guys remember where you were on that day. My Christopher was about 3 months old. And that puts an interesting perspective on life when something like 9/11 happens. And even if one of us were in the buildings that were hit or on the plane that went down, does it mean God doesn't love us? Or if we had family in one of those situations? Does it mean God doesn't love us when we suffer persecution? And we probably haven't gone through a whole lot, so I'm going to borrow from China and Iran and Turkey, okay? The top right corner with that girl, can you see that scar? That's a machete scar. She lived in China and was punished for being a part of the church, being a believer, and not going along with the party line. The man's back you see next to her is in Iran. He and his wife were both whipped. I can't tell you how many times or with what exactly. It definitely wasn't a cat of nine tails. Whipped and beaten for being a part of a local Christian group and having devotions. And the man on his back there with the two yellow-clad people with him is dead. He was killed with two other believers because they were part of a Christian publishing house in Turkey. Okay, and Turkey is not nearly as volatile as Iran, but there are people that are. Did God not love them? Does God no longer love us when that happens? Really wakes you up, doesn't it? This list is awesome. Here's the next one. Famine. Does God not love us when we have famine or hunger? Okay, this guy's sign, you might not be able to read it. It says, very hungry, please, and then help, I think, is covered by his arm. Maybe none of us have been in that situation. Maybe some of you have been hungry, not sure where your next meal is coming from, and it's been a couple days. I don't know. One that kind of goes hand in hand with it is, how does the NIV say it again? Nakedness, which is probably better translated exposure or destitute, okay? Which, you know, this lady's got all her possessions in a bag and a couple grocery sacks, and she's eating yogurt for dinner somewhere. Now, we may not be able to identify too much with that, even though we see people in those situations. We may have never experienced it. There's a couple of you in here. All of us have experienced high gas prices. If you can read that, the low grade is an arm, the plus is a leg, and the premium is your firstborn. We've all experienced that, and those prices have been going up. They've come down again in the last week or so. But you notice they're going up. You know why? The value of the dollar is dropping, and oil is pinned to the dollar. Not because there's less oil or because the price of oil is going up, but because the value of the dollar is going down. That goes down low enough, we have the other pictures revisiting us from the 30s. Not many of you remember the Great Depression, but a few of you do. I certainly don't, but it wouldn't take very much at this point to take us down that path in a hurry. So maybe we don't identify with the homeless guy who's got the, you know, I'm very hungry sign. And maybe we don't identify with the lady with her bags. But we all could in a hurry. If we have to start grouping up and everybody, you know, like three families living in a one-room apartment or something like that just to be able to survive, God no longer love us? If we've got to figure out where we're going to get food from, does God no longer love us? The automatic reaction, the natural reaction would be, yeah, maybe. But that's not what this says. Danger is the next one. And that's a natural danger, not just like, not persecution per se, but just like, you know, accidentally finding a rattlesnake the hard way, or, you know, driving alongside a drunk driver and not even knowing it. You know, you can come up with all the different ways there's danger. You know, dangerous roads, slippery roads, icy roads, danger. Okay? Paul used the same Greek word in a passage in, I think it's 1st or 2nd Corinthians, I can't remember now, where he says, I was in danger at sea, I was in danger at land, I was in danger from my countrymen, I was in danger from Gentiles. You know, he's just in danger, just all the time, is what that was expressing. And it means danger. You get bitten by a snake, you have to go to the hospital, you're within an inch of your life. God not love you because of that? Does that prove that God doesn't love you? And the last one, sword, which is really translated sword. I was really expecting a better translation for that when I looked into the Greek, and it's sword, okay? But the intention of it is to be threatened with death, okay? To be threatened with death specifically, not just danger around, lurking, but being specifically threatened with death, whether that's persecution or being in the wrong bank at the wrong time, or whatever the case may be. Yeah, being at Columbine High School many years ago, and all the other places that's happened since. God's not really loving when that kind of stuff goes down, right? I mean, come on, let's be real. A bunch of kids senselessly lose their lives. God's not really loving. Maybe he's not really there. Sorry, Paul's been through all of these, and he's the one, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, saying, what's going to separate us from the love of Christ? Any of this stuff? It does make sense why people would wrongly think about God's love like this if they aren't convinced and given to it completely, and they're beaten up by frustration and fear and pain before it comes. They're not ready for it. And even sometimes when they are, it can really consume you. But if you are prepared ahead of time and committed to trusting him, no matter what comes, anything from the flat tire to the gun in the face, it will be different. Now, you'll still go through the stuff. It could still be really hard, but life will be vastly different for you. And this isn't like a, you'll be jolly and singing every day. You know, it might be more like, you know, Paul and Silas worshiping God in prison with chains that were probably, you know, chafing their hands and wrists and ankles, okay? But your perspective on life will be radically different. And you'll actually be able to follow Christ talking about not being afraid of, you know, whoever might be able to kill the body. You will have hope and peace through all because of his love in the face of it all. That really kind of ties back to the who can be against this thing. No fear of death? Who can be against us? You know, suddenly it's clear. Through him, we defeat all. We are more than conquerors. We are overly victorious. We defeat all. We are not even afraid of dying. You know, okay, I'm back to William Wallace. Freedom! You know, there is nothing that can destroy us. We will not be beaten down by flat tires or persecution or death. Don't you think you'd probably live differently facing life like that? This is a paradigm assault for some, okay? A perspective adjustment for some, for all of us at least, I would think to some degree. But it really is different when we're not ruled by our circumstances. Let's go ahead and finish this passage. Verse 36. For I am convinced, Paul's taking it even further, I am convinced that neither death nor life, nor neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Nothing means nothing. I mean, Paul leaves nothing out except God, who is already clearly for us. Okay, all creation, that counts for everything except God, the only uncreated one. Right? That includes Satan. Can't do it. Demons, even a legion of demons, can't do it. Armies, it's not going to happen. Nothing means nothing. There are no possibilities left, not even ourselves, to separate us from his love and thwart his plan if you love him and are called according to his purpose. I love that all creation clause. We should never doubt it. Okay. Looking back over what we've seen in this passage, think back to that first verse, okay? God's love allows us to go through everything we experience. One, to bring him more glory. Two, to make us more like his son. And three, to accomplish his purpose for us individually, for his people, and for the world. Kind of like a jigsaw puzzle, okay? Can you guys tell what that is? Amy, don't say anything. Christopher, don't say anything. I got a wink. I love his wink. You put your hand down. Josh, don't say anything. You're very perceptive. It's like a jigsaw puzzle. Sometimes the pieces go in smoothly and easy, and other times they're a squeeze. But our life is like a jigsaw puzzle where we don't get to see the whole picture. It's just, you know, this mess of pieces that we don't really always understand how they fit together. It makes no sense to us sometimes. Sometimes we can kind of see, oh, look what God was doing. Look at that. 3 years ago, I didn't even know this person, and he was working it all to happen here. Whatever the case may be. Sometimes we get glimpses, but a lot of the time it's like we're trying to put a jigsaw puzzle together, or thinking we're trying to do it, and we don't get to see what the picture is on the box, you know? It's just a big mess of pieces. We don't know how it should look. Maybe we do now. But the one putting the puzzle together does know what it should look like. And he will make us just as he wants us to be. With every good and bad thing, in far as we consider good and bad. And I asked the youth this, do you see your life through the lens of God's love and his plan? This is a contact lens. One of them thought it was a surfboard. But do you see the good and the bad? There's a coffin and somebody going, yay! You know, do you see the good and the bad, everything, all the components of your life through the lens of God's love and his plan? Or do you tend to judge God's love and his plan and the validity of it and the power of it and the reality of it by what goes on in your life? That's what we're being confronted with this passage. This is the thrust. What is influencing your perspective? How are you approaching life? Put that back the right way. There's a big difference, and it affects everything about your life and how you live it. So we're going to take some time to respond to this. We're going to take some time to respond. And whether you sing right away, or you spend time asking God to help you trust him and his plan in the midst of whatever you have gone through, are going through, and will go through, take whatever time you need. We're gonna be a little meditative. And then we'll declare our trust for him. But you take the time you need, whether you join us singing right away or it takes a little bit.